I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few moments, a conversation about No Child Left Inside, a movement to get kids off iPods and out into nature, and to get their parents over fears of letting them go. But first, authorities in London say a Scottish house rented by two of the suspects in the foiled Glasgow airport attacks was used as a bomb factory. The house was only a few miles from the airport, where a jeep loaded with gasoline and explosives was driven into a barrier wall. Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown says Britain will thoroughly review its policies for screening foreign doctors, with revelations that six of the eight suspects in custody are foreign-born physicians. The other two are a medical student and a medical assistant. Stryker McGuire is London bureau chief of Newsweek magazine. And Stryker, I want to start with the house angle, the house that's being searched. It's interesting because earlier this week, a Scottish rental agent said he was called by British authorities just before the Glasgow attacks about a house. We don't know if it's the same house.
No.
Right. But what has been found in the house that is being searched?
Well, we don't know yet, and I think the police will be very cautious about that. But it is worth going back just a few days to, you remember the bombing in London, mm-hmm. and there were mobile phones, cell phones that were found at that time. They apparently traced some numbers to Glasgow. That was the way in which they connected these two bombing attempts. And I think that what we're seeing today with the searching is really a sort of outcome of that earlier investigation, which seems like a long time ago, but it was less than a week ago.
Just a few days ago. Well, now authorities are talking about a multinational circle of medical workers. It's a web that spans from Britain to Bangalore to Brisbane, Australia. Tell us, you know, how these people are alleged to be connected.
Well, this is, of course, the trickiest part of the investigation, and really, at this point, the most difficult thing to report, because obviously that, you know, we all are looking for a narrative here, and what we don't know, frankly, is how that narrative is going to turn out. I guess if I had, you know, if you forced me to guess at this point, I would say that what happened is that a number of doctors from different parts of the world came to the UK, and that they were united mostly at that point. And that, in other words, that the plot, if there was one, mm-hmm. began after they were in the UK, not before they were in the UK. But I have to say, frankly, that depending on what turns out in terms of evidence, I could be totally wrong about that.
Well, I was going to jump in just to say that there's another report that officials say they're intrigued by. It's a report that a British cleric working in Baghdad met with an alleged Al-Qaeda operative in April. The British priest says he was told, "Those who cure you will kill you." And he didn't think anything of it at the time. Now, of course, he's wondering if it did mean something.
Yes. Well, okay. Yes, absolutely. You know, let's not discount what this is, Canon Andrew White, and let's not discount what he says. At the same time, it's also fair to say that there have been a number of accounts in recent months and even years that the sort of war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, that it would spill over into the UK and into the US. This may be what we're seeing now.
And through doctors. I just want to say British Prime Minister Gordon Brown calling for increased scrutiny of foreign professionals. Turns out several of the suspects were already on a watch list compiled by the agency in London.
Well, they were on a list. I'm not sure I would call it a watch list, but they were on a list in the sense that their names had turned up because in one form or another they had communicated with any of a number of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who were on that list. These lists, frankly, are very, very big. They include a lot of people. I don't think that I would argue in this case that the British intelligence services dropped the ball. That there are a lot of people on those lists.
Stryker McGuire, London bureau chief, Newsweek magazine, with still a lot of questions about the investigation in Great Britain. Stryker, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Have you heard of the No Child Left Inside movement? This is a grassroots effort to get kids back to nature, an issue that's even attracted congressional hearings. Consider the statistic. A University of Maryland study found that from 1997 to 2003, there was a 50% drop in the number of kids 9 to 12 who spent time in outdoor activities, and this not including organized sports. That doesn't count. And the Kaiser Family Foundation reports that children age 8 to 18 spend about 6.5 hours a day watching TV, playing video games, or on their computers inside. Well, today a conversation about what child specialists are calling the first generation of indoor kids. We're going to speak with Richard Louv. He's author of Last Child in the Woods. He helped launch this movement to get kids outside. He joins us from the studios of KPBS in San Diego. Welcome.
Thank you.
And now, your book came out about 2 years ago, and as I said, you are credited with getting this movement going. But what would you say to people, and I'm sure you hear people say, well, you know what, we live in a high-tech society. We're no longer farmers or stonemasons. You know, what is really the problem with kids not playing outside that much?
In terms of, you know, what's changed and why it matters, at Harvard, E.O. Wilson, the professor there at Harvard.
Oh, sure, he's the biologist. We actually went hunting ants in the woods with him once. Yes, yes.
Yeah, he's wonderful. And several decades ago, he came up with this phrase, biophilia hypothesis, and Stephen Keller at Yale has helped popularize that. Basically, what that says is that we are all hardwired to be attracted to nature. We are pulled towards certain kinds of landscapes, and that we need it.
Biophilia hypothesis.
Yeah, the pull of the wild. And we respond to this. There was a wonderful study done where they asked people all over the world what kinds of images are you attracted to. In urban cultures, they asked these questions. In suburban, in rural, et cetera, people who had never spent any time outdoors particularly were asked this question. Natural images won. The number one landscape that attracted people visually was the savanna.
Hmm.
Well, where do we all come from if we accept the genetic theory of evolution? Where do we come from? We come from there. So this is in us. We're hardwired for this. And when we don't get it, we don't do so well.
Well, and we know there's an obesity epidemic in the U.S. in particular. People are ascribing that to both the lack of exercise or activity for kids and the junk food that they're eating while they're sitting at their computers. But what, I mean, what else is the problem? Are you saying that kids are feeling this on some level that they're not expressing or we don't know the effects of yet?
When I talk to kids, they actually want to be in nature, many of them, even if they aren't getting it. What often happens is you'll have kids who've never been off the sidewalks. I mean, I talked to the head of a sixth grade camp here in San Diego, and he told me he met a boy who had literally never been off hard surface as far as he could tell. And this kid had a hard time walking on grass and on dirt.
This has been a problem in the inner city with kids who just don't have access to the land, to what we would think of as countryside. But are you speaking of someone who, by all rights, should know what grass is, should know what countryside is, you know, lives maybe in a suburban area, just isn't going out into it?
That, too. A couple thoughts. One is, in terms of the inner cities, there is nature in inner cities. Some of the older cities in America, like Philadelphia, et cetera, are filled with parks. Even in some of the toughest neighborhoods, you'll find vacant lots, et cetera. One of the neat programs run by the Sierra Club called Inner City Outings, and a guy named Martin LeBlanc goes into inner cities, and one of the first things he does is put backpacks on the kids, and he takes them for a five-mile walk within their own neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And they find nature. They find pieces of, you know, areas of grass and in an alley, et cetera. And they really need to look at where they're at. This isn't just a case of, you know, everybody needs to go to Yosemite. Having said that, there are huge numbers of kids in America that have never seen the stars. I mean, literally, when I first started doing this research, I found that hard to believe. But you hear that a lot, that they've never seen a sky full of stars, and they're frightened by it often. What you hear from people who take kids from the inner city out into the woods, et cetera, is that first they are afraid. But, you know, I went with some gang members up near where I live in San Diego to a nature preserve. In the morning, you could tell that they were terrified of that. One boy said, "It's too noisy out here." I said, "What are you talking about? It's too noisy. You live in a neighborhood with gunfire." He says, "Yeah, but there's 4 or 5 sounds in my neighborhood. I know what they all mean. Out here, there are hundreds of sounds, and they seem to mean something. I don't know what it is." By the end of the day, these tough gang members were 8-year-olds jumping over a creek. I mean, this came back to them. You'll hear that also from parents of suburban kids who have a really hard time getting those kids to go with them on camping trips when they still go camping. Kids will be in the back seat whining and complaining the whole time. And then they grow up, and at age 22 or 23, they come home and they say, you know, Dad, Mom, you remember that time we went camping? Wasn't that awesome? Mm-hmm. And the parents want to strangle them because at the time it just seemed like they were torturing these kids. That's what they remember. They won't remember the time they scored really well on Grand Theft Auto, but they'll remember that trip to the outdoors.
Well, so you're saying this, you know, sort of runs across the socioeconomic spectrum, but there was, you know, a portion of society at least at one time that made sure that their kids got outside. They joined the scouts. They went camping. It was almost a prerequisite of being a kid. In addition to the high-tech stuff that's keeping them inside their rooms now, what else is happening? I mean, are parents playing a role in this?
Oh, yeah. Well, first, I'm really careful not to blame parents. We don't need any more guilt as parents, or a sense of guilt. What parents talk about is that they're stressed out, they have to work too many hours, everything's scheduled, they're worried about their kids getting into college, so they got to get them into all these lessons, et cetera, to make them test better.
Is it also, though, about leaving kids unattended, just because of the stories that we've heard of what can happen?
And the underbelly of all of this, of all of these things that parents say, is fear. They are scared to death of stranger danger. Now, some of that fear is very well-founded, but a lot of it is not. If you look at the statistics, you'll find, for instance, the stranger kidnappings. One is too many, but the number has stayed between 200 and 300 for 20 years. If the number is either steady or going down, what's happening? Why is our perception of danger going up? I think if you watch CNN or Fox, you will see very quickly how a handful of terrible crimes against children are reported over and over and over again every year, and it is not reflecting the reality. I want to add here that I'm not suggesting that there is no risk out there. I think we need to begin to think in terms of comparative risk. If we want a truly huge risk, we will look at child obesity. We'll look at raising a generation under protective house arrest and the impact of that on their psychological and physical health. Pediatricians now are talking about this generation of children being the first generation to die at an earlier age, have a lower life expectancy than their parents since World War II. That is a real risk. And yet, what do we do? Broward County, Florida, last year, they started putting up no running signs on the playgrounds. We love nature, supposedly, and yet in our neighborhoods, if you look at the CC&Rs, the covenants and restrictions on almost every new housing development, you'll find that it's impossible to put up a basketball hoop, let alone let the kids build a treehouse or a fort. It's not going to happen.
Liability.
So we're sending all of these messages to these kids that really nature is in the past, the boogeyman is in the woods, and the future is in electronics.
That's Richard Louv. He's author of Last Child in the Woods, one of the driving forces behind the Leave No Child Inside movement. So when we come back, you know, what are some of the solutions? Getting developers to build around nature, getting parents over their fears. That's after a break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with more from Richard Louv, author of Last Child in the Woods. And we've been hearing some really, you know, sad statistics about kids not spending as much free time outside. Now we want to hear what can be done. The National Wildlife Federation has started promoting a green hour. This is the idea that the kids need a casual hour outside every day. It's, you know, outside of organized sports. Rich, what are some of the other programs out there?
The Sierra Club has its Building Bridges to the Outdoors program. The Conservation Fund has launched this National Forum on Children and Nature to get kids outdoors and actually raise some money to do it. Most importantly, I think, in addition to organizations like the Sierra Club, et cetera, you've got these regional movements that are emerging all over the country. For instance, in Cincinnati, where I was recently, they signed up people to do what they could in their neighborhoods. And this isn't only conservation groups at all. This is also businesses, public health, developers, surprisingly enough, who now are quite interested in designing development, some of them, that would actually connect kids and their parents to nature. And through the design, I was just at a conference last week that Clint Eastwood held in Carmel and asked me to come up and give my sermonette to 30 of the major developers. And they got very excited about nature trails through natural habitat to the surrounding schools. We could have kids working as nature guides, kind of like crossing guards. Mm-hmm. We could have a little nature center on that land that would help parents with their fear. And we could sell all that as an amenity. So there's that kind of thinking. Now, where that leads, we don't know yet. We don't know if they'll follow through. So there are self-interest groups throughout America that are taking this on.
You make me want to pack up every kid I know and take them, you know, to camp out. By the way, Connecticut, state officials there launched the No Child Left Inside program last year. And one of the things they're doing is allowing foster families to use state parks for free and encouraging families to visit parks. There's a contest called the Great Park Pursuit. Other states have that as well. It's sort of a treasure hunt, you know, taking people to the parks and through the parks. You coined a term, nature deficit disorder. We were talking about what some of the problems are for kids and not being able to respond to this. I've written it down. Biophilial hypothesis, this draw of the wild that they're not acting on. What is this nature deficit disorder?
Well, first, I'm very careful in the book to not present that as an existing medical disorder. It's really a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but people get it. I mean, when parents hear this, they know what it means. We haven't really had a language until recently to really talk about this issue, so now that language is emerging, and some of it is based on what we already know. I think of this as more of a disorder of the society. I think a kid can grow up just fine without nature in his or her life, but that life would be enormously enriched with nature in it. And that good things come with that. And we now know, for instance, at the University of Illinois, doing an ongoing set of studies on kids with the symptoms of attention deficit disorder, that the symptoms get much better with just a little bit of contact with nature. Kids as young as 5 years old. And kids in general, their attention span gets longer when they spend more time in nature. Creativity, studies of how kids play in natural play areas versus the flat playground that we typically have. The kids in the natural play areas are far more likely to invent their own games. Cognitive benefits, they test better. Kids test better on science, for instance, when they spend more time learning about science outdoors, and on. So these psychological and physical and even spiritual benefits are very much there, and this body of knowledge has emerged quite recently, and I believe everybody needs to know about that, and parents want to be good parents, and they'll get that for their kids, even if they didn't have that themselves when they were kids. And we have to remember there's a generation of young parents coming up right now that many of them did not have that experience when they were kids. And to them, I say, you know, think of all the first things we do as parents. This could be a first thing. And now's your chance. You missed out. Now you can take your child into nature. And by the way, in terms of the fear, I'm not pretending that we can go back to the 1950s anytime soon. That fear is not going to go away. Therefore, I think three things have to happen. First off, that information about the good things that nature experience brings children and their development, that information needs to get out there to parents. The second thing is that as parents, we need to take our kids out into nature ourselves. And the third thing is we have to support the institutions and the organizations that have, for years, been out there struggling to get kids into nature and support the new ones that emerge. And that's everything from nature centers to the scouting organizations to the schools that still have some kind of outdoor classroom to the what's emerging now, as I'm very interested in, is the idea of nature preschools. We can do much, much more, and we have to support those institutions and organizations.
Well, meanwhile, are there kids in suburban neighborhoods, you know, still running around at night playing hide-and-seek and tag? Or do you see this as, you know, something that's obsolete?
It could be obsolete. In some neighborhoods, it is happening to, I think, a limited extent. But so many neighborhoods you'll drive through, not just at night, but in the morning, in the afternoon. And those of us who can remember Twilight Zone, you know, after the nuclear attack and nobody's around.
Right. Where is everybody?
Nobody's there.
Right.
So many neighborhoods have that feeling now today. In terms of the fear of letting kids just go out there, again, this isn't going to happen accidentally. It is going to happen with parental involvement. It won't be as it was when I was a kid, that in most neighborhoods where the mom would say, go outside and don't come back until the streetlights come on.
Right.
I don't think that's going to happen in many neighborhoods. What can happen, though, is that parents in those neighborhoods can agree that several of them will stay outside and they will watch and they will make sure that the kids can play those games again.
Maybe rotate the parent who has to do that. Oh, that's so sad.
But again, you know, the good news here is that I never would have expected the response to this book that has occurred. You know, it was wishful thinking, I thought, at the time to think that maybe a movement could come out of this. But it is happening, and that response itself gives me a great deal of hope. People really don't want this to go away. They don't want future generations to miss out on that experience. When I gave testimony in Congress a few weeks ago. It was very interesting. People on all sides of the political spectrum. There were six congressmen. I'm told that's a good turnout. After I spoke, all they wanted to talk about was what it was like when they were boys and how could that end. And in those moments, there were no Democrats in the room and there were no Republicans in the room. They were people with a memory. And we can't be the last generation with that memory. We have to pass that on.
Richard Louv, author of Last Child in the Woods. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, a look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Daniel Handler, the eccentric author of the Lemony Snicket book for kids, has a collection of short stories about life and love for grown-ups. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, how much freedom do employees have to speak their minds at work? Well, it turns out not much, even when you're not on the job. That's after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And this week, as we celebrate America's independence, we're taking time to ask the question, how much freedom of speech do Americans have at work? Can you be fired for having your favorite candidate's bumper sticker on your car? Can you be fired if you refuse to wear a button for your boss's favorite cause? Well, Vanderbilt University Management Professor Bruce Barry says, by and large, yes to both. Especially if you're a private sector employee, they're much less protected than workers in the public sector. His book is Speechless, The Erosion of Free Expression in the American Workplace, and he joins us from KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. Professor, let's take a couple of the examples I just mentioned. The woman fired because she had a John Kerry bumper sticker. She knew her boss was a Bush supporter because he'd put flyers in his workers' paychecks about how he felt Bush policy had benefited them. Her firing was legal?
It was, in part because she lived in Alabama. There are some states where she would have had some legal remedies possible. It's a really extreme example. I think it's an important one because it shows just how much power employers have to police worker speech. I'm not going to argue that managers all over the country are roaming parking lots checking bumper stickers, but it does define the territory.
Another case I gave, employees at a Wyoming newspaper lost their jobs after refusing to wear anti-union buttons.
They had no recourse there. They did try to take the employer to court, and a court ruled against them, saying that they don't sort of reserve the right to avoid saying things that management wants them to say while they're on the premises at work.
On the premises is key because you go on to point out that it often doesn't matter if you're writing in your blog at home or if you're not at work and, you know, emailing, but the contents are still troubling to your employer, you can be fired.
Well, the basic principles of employment law basically grant employers the right to fire people for just about anything, good reason, bad reason, even no reason, and that can include off-work activity. There are exceptions. There are some states, a small number of states, that have written into the law some protections against employers interfering with your off-work activity if it's legal. But even those laws are imperfect. There was a fellow in Denver, Colorado, who wrote a letter to the editor. He worked for an airline, for Delta, and he wrote a letter to the editor of the newspaper. This was complaining actually about some Delta practices, but very public ones, not private workplace issues. And Delta fired him for insubordination, and Colorado happens to be one of the states that has one of these laws protecting off-work behavior. And he sued under that law. Delta said, though, that he had violated kind of a duty of loyalty, and the court sided with Delta. And what I find in the book, as I look at these cases around the country and these different laws that vary so much, is that courts, not always, but frequently seem to defer to these employer claims that some activity of off-work speech or even work-related speech really is going to harm the business. And I think that sometimes courts defer too much.
Well, let's flip it around and play devil's advocate. If you're an employer and you've invested a lot of money in your company and you have, you know, a feeling that you have the right to ask people to be supportive of the company, supportive of the product. If, for instance, in the case of, you know, somebody who is blogging about how they hate the company, don't you have the right to say, look, this is my investment. If you want to say that, you can go.
Yes, I think employers do have the right to be concerned about that, and they certainly have the right to exact some kind of sense of loyalty from employees toward the business or toward the organization and what it's trying to do. But I'm concerned that when employers come down hard on speech, it sends a message, a chilling message to everyone else. Employers are watching. They have this power. They may be willing to use it. And my concern is that employees will then self-censor around things that really do matter.
I'm so struck by the online writing that gets people fired. We're aware of emails, blogging. I mean, many people are becoming aware that they don't entirely have complete freedom of speech when their employers are concerned there. But I was fascinated to read about places like MySpace, these new sort of, you know, community meeting places. People may think that they have sort of a firewall because, you know, you can prohibit people from getting into your space. But you write that some employers are asking college interns to troll the MySpaces, the places where somebody would let in maybe a college student with a college ID on their email.
Well, young people who are living out their adolescence with creating an online footprint, especially through these social networking sites like MySpace and Facebook, are coming to discover the implications of having that online footprint. And increasingly, universities, for example, in their placement offices are cautioning students to be careful of the online presence you create because employers may be, as you say, trolling and looking for that as some sort of insight or window into the character of these people as job applicants. Now, a lot of the advice is, so just don't do it. Be careful. Don't put stuff online that suggests some sort of inappropriate self. But I think that employers also have to come to understand that it's a different world, that the people who are growing up in their teens and 20s and 30s who are creating this online presence and this online life, that's the culture in which they're growing up. And I think that employers will do themselves a disservice if they come down too hard on it with a kind of a no-tolerance approach, because I think they'll discover they're losing good talent because they haven't quite caught up to today's online digital culture.
Mm. Well, once they get to the workplace, you write about cases of employees fired for expressing religious views, fired for expressing their own political views, or negative views about the company. Again, devil's advocate. What about employees who want to be protected from other workers' views? Is that the employer's job, to protect employees from other employees' personal speech?
I suppose that's a reasonable way to describe how some people might view the workplace. I will say that I'm not terribly sympathetic to the idea that people should be protected from speech. An employer might have the power to force people to sit in stony silence while executing their tasks and not interact with one another, but that's not how the real world of real people in real jobs works.
And we rush to say that you do point out that employees are protected from hateful or derogatory speech. You write about Lois Robinson, the Florida welder who sued after experiencing years of harassment. But how do you feel about the story that's in our area, the women who were accused of gossiping about the town administrator in the town of Hooksett, New Hampshire, and were fired for gossiping?
Yes, I know that case. And my own view is that employers have a right to be concerned with that kind of speech, but they should restrain their worst impulses to have kind of a hair trigger of intolerance toward it. I mean, you're talking there about the kind of speech that's gone on since there have been jobs and workplaces and bosses and coworkers. This happens to be a case where an employer found out about it and wanted to react very impulsively with the kind of, you know, workplace death penalty, fire people for that. And I think that the problem, in part, is it's not just that the law gives employers too much power. It's that employers too instinctively take that power and turn it into kind of a managerial impulse to worry about speech, to regard it as threatening even when it's only very, very mildly subversive. And so part of what I call for in the book is for employers to sort of rethink their role in all of this, to try to imagine themselves a little bit more as partners in a democratic system where free speech, even free speech by workers, even sometimes at work, is part of the expressive life that makes deliberative democracy healthy.
Bruce Barry, professor of management and sociology at Vanderbilt University. His book is Speechless, The Erosion of Free Expression in the American Workplace. He's been speaking to us from KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. Professor Barry, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
We'll take a second to take care of a little business here with a reminder that you can hear our program anytime on our website, here-now.org. Click on Archives, find all our past programs. You can also download a podcast, take us with you when you travel, and find us on XM Radio Channel 133 as well. Before we go today, Chad Vader, Day Shift Manager. You're listening to Here and Now. Fans of The Simpsons are eagerly awaiting July 27th. That's the day America's most dysfunctional family moves from TV's fictional Springfield, USA, to the big screen in the new Simpsons movie. But residents of real-life Springfields are eagerly awaiting next week. That's when they find out which Springfield is chosen to host the film's premiere. 20th Century Fox decided to hold the premiere in whichever Springfield makes the best promotional short film for the movie. It's all going to be decided by popular vote on the web. Well, Springfield, Massachusetts is one of 14 Springfields that have entered the competition, and we sent Here Now's Chris Cuff to this Western Massachusetts contender to find out more.
Now, we're going to do a little acting. This time, when I say action, you're going to go do, 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 and then throw your arms up, all right? One, two, three, action.
A group, do. What better way to honor the Simpsons movie than with Homer Simpson's signature phrase? Fearing neither the nation's ridicule nor being compared to what Newsweek called America's crud bucket, a group of filmmakers from Springfield, Massachusetts, banded together to face Fox's challenge. Their movie trailer comes across like a fake news program, bent on investigating why theirs is the real home to the Simpsons.
Tonight on Perfect Vision, Springfield, Mass., the little city that's complaining about Matt Groening.
Marty Langford helped write the script and says the project was a labor of love.
I know Dave Horrigan, who's the executive producer, really well, and when this thing came into town, he contacted me and said, hey, we got to, you know, if something's going to happen in Springfield and it's film-related, you know, we have to get our core group of guys together who are Western Mass natives, you know, who love The Simpsons and who are really into kind of an interesting project.
In true Simpsonian style, the filmmakers didn't hire real actors for the final scene. Instead, they set up shop at the tail end of the city's Father's Day parade route. Word must have gotten out because lots of Simpsons fans were there. They were dressed in a motley assortment of t-shirts and jeans, homemade costumes, brightly colored hair and painted faces. Many proudly sported Simpsons t-shirts. For this scene, they're standing in front of an old white church in the center of town. People are hanging out of two buses in the background, an old-fashioned double-decker bus and another that looks like something out of an Art Deco painting, covered in streamlined chrome and colorful paint. The group's PR guy, Tony Signoli, tells me the church is of strategic importance.
They call it the Church of the St. Michaels. It's the spinning image of St. Michael's Cathedral on State Street. Their nuclear power plant looks exactly like the power plant that we can see from Springfield across the Connecticut River. Their high school, the Springfield High School, is exactly the same cartoon image of Commerce High School in the city of Springfield. And there's so many comparisons.
Take, for instance, Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy. Long rumored to be at least part of the inspiration for The Simpsons' fictional mayor, Diamond Joe Quimby, Kennedy helped out with a scene from his office in Washington.
We cordially invite all of the Simpsons, Marge, Homer, Bart, old Diamond Joe Quimby, Lisa and Maggie and Abe, to join us in Springfield, Massachusetts. Just think, after 400 episodes, you'll even be able to enjoy some real chowda.
Fans like Fred Stevenson are hoping the Simpsons accept the senator's invitation. Stevenson watches the show every night with his daughter when the rest of his kids are in bed. The next time he sees The Simpsons, the red carpet could be rolling out in Springfield, Massachusetts.
I think it went pretty good. I hope we won. That'd be something good for Springfield.
Well, good luck. But let's not forget the other 13 Springfields. And while we're at it, not that I'm biased or anything, but as a Scot, I should note that two Springfields in Scotland are also trying to get in on the challenge, offering to host the UK premiere of The Simpsons movie.
Here now is Chris Cuff in Springfield, Massachusetts, to watch videos from all 14 Springfields that are vying for the chance to host the hometown premiere of The Simpsons movie. Go to our website, here-now.org, where you can also cast your vote for the Springfield that you think deserves this honor. Just ahead, a different take on Star Wars. It's the saga of the villainous Darth Vader's less talented brother, Chad. No, he's not the scourge of the Jedi. Chad works as a supervisor at a Wisconsin grocery store.
I sense potential in you, young one.
Yeah!
I shall take you on as my apprentice, Jeremy. Together we shall decimate the competition and conquer the food retailing industry.
That would be awesome!
Yes, it shall be awesome. Clean that up, Jeremy.
May the farce be with you after a break, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A long, long time ago, 30 years this summer to be exact, the Star Wars universe was born. Since that first space saga with Luke, Leia, Han Solo, and of course Chewbacca, there have been 5 more films. Star Wars creator George Lucas says, though there are 2 TV series planned, there will be no more features. So, how is he going to reach the new generation? Well, Lucas is offering fans the chance to create their own Star Wars films on the internet. He's posted more than 250 clips online that fans can remix or mash up. And with his permission, other budding filmmakers are making their own movies out of whole cloth, or what looks like bedsheets. You can see some of these short films on our website, here-now.org. Here's a clip from the one George Lucas picked as the winner of this year's Star Wars Fan Movie Challenge. It's called Chad Vader, Day Shift Manager. It's a series about Darth Vader's less talented brother, Chad. Instead of battling the Force, Chad Vader works in a Wisconsin grocery store.
Our plans to make this station fully operational on Saturday may be jeopardized.
Look, just get someone to take your shift, okay, Chad?
As you wish.
Oh, Chad, I heard you're having some problems with Clint.
Clint is a fool. And I will not tolerate his insolence much longer.
Well, you're going to have to resolve it. I can't have my day manager and my night manager at each other's throats all the time.
Yes, Emperor.
It's Randy! Randy!
Chad, the overzealous manager of the food market. The Chad Vader series has been downloaded about 13 million times, and its creators join us now. Aaron Yanda, do I understand you're the body of Chad Vader?
Yep, I wear the suit. I get to do all the physical comedy and running around and stuff like that.
Right. And Matt Sloan, you're the dubbed-in voice?
I am the voice. I also play Clint, Chad's nemesis.
Yes, right. And can we just have a little, is Chad Vader with us in voice now, Matt? Can you resurrect him?
Well, I can do the kind of unplugged version of Chad.
Yes.
I don't have my the special equipment that I need to make my voice sound as much like Darth Vader as we can. But you have failed me for the last time.
And he's so pathetic. He's just so sad. he's the boss that nobody listens to, even though he has this great black Darth Vader outfit. How'd you come up with Chad?
Well, we had this idea for Darth Vader working in a grocery store that a friend of mine had come up with, and we liked it, but we wanted to do something different with it because we wanted to make a story. So we decided to change it to Chad Vader, Darth Vader's brother. He has, the same suit, he's got the same powers, but he doesn't quite have the same backbone and charisma and ability to use the powers effectively.
Well, the funny thing is, if any of the characters from Star Wars did plop into a supermarket, that is how people would treat them. Like, yeah, sure, you have a...
Right, exactly.
The episodes are about 5 minutes long, but there's a lot of work in it, a lot of editing, special effects, there's a lightsaber. Matt, how do you do this? How much money does it take to do it, and where do you get the return?
We're lucky enough to have so many people who at this point are willing to volunteer to work on the series. We've got some connections here in Madison, Wisconsin.
I'll say you do. You got the mayor to appear.
What is the meaning of this?
The meaning of what, Mr. Mayor?
I ordered this task completed an hour ago.
Oh, you did?
You have failed me for the last time.
The mayor contacted us, and he wanted to be in the show. So we were able to stick him in a couple episodes. The real resource is the fact that we're able to get so many locations and so many actors and crew people who are just willing to kind of donate their time to make something that is fun to make and has now gained some notoriety.
Well, and Aaron, what about the supermarket? What supermarket is that?
The Willie Street Co-op here in Madison. It's a really great place. It's a co-op, and I don't know if you can tell that from when we're shooting it. It pretty much looks like a normal grocery store, except for the all the products are called crazy names that are not mainstream brand products.
They must be thrilled that they allowed you to film in there, and now they've had, 13 million mini advertisements when people go on to watch it.
Yeah, I think they're very happy about that. There was a time when we'd done the 2 or 3 episodes when they started to get a little tired of us always, calling them up and asking to use the store again and again. And then a newspaper article came out that said, Sith Lord works at Willie Street Co-op, and, it was like on the front page, and they sort of relented after that. And they were like, you can use the store.
And now George Lucas picks your films over all the other fan films, many of them, as we said, mashups. You don't use the clips that he's put online. What has that done for you?
This is Matt. I think it's really given us sort of credibility in the entertainment industry, the hardest industry to get involved in pretty much in the world. As you said, we don't use any clips or footage from the movies. Everything is just shot, from scratch. And I think people in various sectors of the industry are really responding to that. A lot of people have commented on the show and saying it has a real different sensibility from things that are made in New York and things that are made in L.A., and I think that has really made an impact on people. And, we have an agent, William Morris, and we're just talking to a lot of networks and things like that. So it's really gotten our careers rolling.
In Little Madison, Wisconsin, I mean, it's, Madison's a big town in Wisconsin, but still, it's, it's not L.A. or New York.
Exactly.
I'm wondering, too, if people haven't seen this, it's sort of like picture if Steve Carroll in The Office wore a Darth Vader outfit while he tried to get people to listen to him. This is what Chad Vader in the supermarket is like. But you also incorporate a lot of lines that I wouldn't know them as much as a Star Wars aficionado would. Give me an example of when you'd have him say something in the course of being the supermarket manager that's lifted right out of the films.
Well, actually, Matt, what's a good example of a line that we use?
Chad quits his job, and he gets a job as a telemarketer, and he's calling this guy and trying to get him to switch his long distance.
Hello? Hello?
Good afternoon, Mr. or Mrs. Grizz.
Yes.
Grizzy, Mr. Would you call yourself fully satisfied with your long-distance carrier, Mr. Grizzy? Mr. Grizzy, how do you pronounce this name?
You people aren't even supposed to call me after 7 o'clock. I looked it up.
I will go ahead and switch your long-distance service for you. There may be a slight...
I never said I wanted to switch long-distance carriers.
I am altering the deal. Pray I don't alter it any further.
So that's a line from the movie. That's what Darth Vader says to Lando Calrissian on Cloud City. But you don't have to know those lines to enjoy the series. And a lot of people have commented and said, I actually have never seen Star Wars. I don't know who these people are, how they haven't seen Star Wars, but they actually say that they enjoy it, even though they don't necessarily get all the references.
What's the benefit to you besides the glory that's now been showered upon you by George Lucas? How do you make money by doing this?
We've gotten some commercial work locally and nationally, and we also are on the beta version of the YouTube revenue sharing program. So we get money for the videos that we upload to YouTube. I think they're only doing that with a select number of YouTube subscribers. So that is exciting to be, the first people to be involved with that.
Right. Well, and as we said, you've been downloaded about 13 million times. So tell us, how much are you getting?
Well, we're not really supposed to talk about that.
Oh, come on. just us. This is just us. Well, I got to look closer at this, whole YouTube thing. Aaron Yanda, Matt Sloan, write, direct, edit, and act in Chad Vader, Day Shift Manager. You can see their work at our website, here-now.org, and they'll give us a portion of their monies from YouTube. Maybe not. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin. Thanks a lot.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.